Hi, welcome to the Dan Bradbury podcast, where turnover is vanity, profit is sanity, and cash is king. In this podcast, I'll bring you resources, tips, interviews, and lots more to help to grow your business and make it less dependent on you. In every recession, there are two types of people that do well. One, the rich get richer. So people with money do well in recessions. And the reason why is people feel like, generally speaking, there's less available capital and that people feel like they need money. So you can buy assets cheaper. A house that was just yesterday, a friend of a friend bought a £750,000 house for £540,000. And this is just the beginning, right? There'll probably be a decrease in property prices. There's already a decrease in business prices, businesses that are for sale. So you can buy valuable assets for less money. And then you can ride the wave back up. But that's people with money. And by the way, this current cycle is even more interesting because there's so much liquidity. The Chancellor pumped so much money into the economy and things like the bounce back loans. In real terms, there's no recession in memory, in history, where businesses have been so liquid as this one. It appears to me that the lessons have been learned since the crash of the previous crash of 08-09, and the banks are much more well capitalized and the money is being lent out. So that's point one. The second type of person, which is more interesting, is entrepreneurs, because we live in very changing times. And so it's no longer business as usual. And the businesses that are unable to adapt to the new socially distanced working conditions and ways of dealing with customers, etc., many of them will fail. Loads of businesses are going to fail, but the ones who can adapt are going to thrive, okay? Because people are still going to want to go out to eat. They're going to want to exercise. They're going to want all the services that they had before, maybe some more than others. But the fact is, if the businesses can't adapt, the money will go to a business that can meet those needs. And that's where entrepreneurs come in. If you look at some of the biggest companies in the world today, they were created, they were born during the last recession 10 years ago. Okay, the Airbnbs, etc. Okay, so now is your time if you're flexible, if you can adapt. Add on to that, our technology's never been better, globalization, et cetera, et cetera. Baby boomers coming of age. I've got a friend who's an accountant that has been talking about how many of his clients have said, you know what, I'm not even going to open again. I'm just going to close down. I can't be asked with the hassle of kind of rejigging and retooling the business for this new world that we operate in. So they're going to close down the business or they're going to sell it off cheap. Hence, there's going to be a greater transfer of wealth in this economic cycle than at any time in human history. The question is, are you on the right side of the equation? Have you adapted your business accordingly? Now it appears we are opening up again. Let me talk about what I believe to be one of the biggest risks that you're facing, and that is your business model could be broken. Think about this. The easy thing is to always justify the status quo, to cling on, hoping it's going to go back to normal. But the ostrich defense is not your friend, right? And the head in the sand technique doesn't work. Said, as a mentor of mine told me a long time ago, he said, Dan, facts don't cease to become facts just because you ignore them. The world has changed. And therein lies your opportunity. You can either sit still and get battered by the changing market trends, right? All business is driven by customers ultimately about what they're willing to do and not do. And whether it's short-term or long-term, whether it's temporary or permanent, the fact is what customers want, what they're doing, how they're behaving has changed. So you can either sit still, cling on and get battered, or you can take advantage. Ethically, I get a head start on your competition by adapting when they won't. Let me give you a great example of this. An article appeared on the Inc.com website recently, about Starbucks. And a great quote in this article, it was talking about Starbucks having a major shift. The business strategy that they've held for almost two decades now of the third place is changing. So if you don't know the Starbucks story, Starbucks was fundamentally founded around the fact that there was home, there was work, and Starbucks aspired to being the third place where people go. But like most large businesses that have grown rapidly, Starbucks really analyzes data heavily. And even before COVID, they noticed almost now 80% of their customers don't have their drinks in store. It was takeaway. So Starbucks was already transitioning and preparing for what I believe they call a Starbucks pickup, right? Effectively a pop-up Starbucks. But COVID-19 has accelerated that. So the quote in this article, which is interesting, was that stood out for me was, no matter the format, we know that the Starbucks third place experience occurs from the moment a customer envisions their daily Starbucks experience to wherever they enjoy that Starbucks beverage. In other words, Starbucks are closing 400 company-owned stores this year, right? They're accelerating the closure of those stores and replacing them with these pickup shops, right? They're trying to adapt because the external environment has changed. So the article posed three questions that I thought were worth sharing with you. Question number one, what about my customers has changed in the past 2 years and what can I learn from it? Number two, what am I not currently offering that would interest my customers? And number three, how can I improve the customer experience? How can I make things easier for them? They're great questions and well worth thinking about. Yeah, well, I mean, let's talk about that. I mean, obviously, this way you and I are kindred spirits. I mean, I write a book on the topic, which obviously isn't about accountancy, but against speaking to the fact that so many business owners are frustrated because they're driving revenue. And even if they succeed in doing that, they fail to turn it into profit and not understanding the difference between profit and cash flow even more so. So what does that show up like? Like, how do you transition that into something that's valuable for clients? You know, I know you've got a great analogy on this topic, I think, which sits quite well. What is it, I suppose it's almost, what is the mindset and mentality of a business owner that stuck versus the business owners that are making more progress? How do they think about the numbers differently, and how do you create that value and add the value for your clients?
So first thing we try and make sure that we've got this actually everywhere where we're talking to clients is, one of the main reasons people tend to move into owning a business web description, even though there might be some other trigger behind it, is that actually they feel they can take an element of control and they can start thriving in their life and not just be surviving. One of the things we have is, let's stop business owners just surviving and start thriving, because what tends to have happened is somewhere along the way, they've forgotten that and they end up in this trap where they've just taken on more and more work, working ridiculous hours, the margins have been lost, and suddenly they're working, I don't know, 70 hours a week for below minimum wage. And so the big thing is that we can change their mindset, and traditional accounting and the services that accountants provide don't help them with that, because they're constantly looking backwards. I think the analogy I refer to is my one by sort of running a business, a bit like driving a car. You should be focused on looking forward with the odd glances sort of into the rearview mirror to see where you've been, to help that and make decisions about where you're going. Whereas most accountants are driving along, helping business owners just looking full-time in the rearview mirror, looking backwards, often far, far too late and looking far too far backwards.
Let me jump in there, Ian, because I'm aware that we're both coming from bias and a lot of people listening may not have the perspective. So let's break down how it's different. So in my experience, a lot of business owners are coming in there that they see as an accountant as a extension of a necessity for tax function, right? They're going, right, yes, we need to do VAT returns. Yeah, we need to file a set of statutory accounts. Oh yeah, we've got to run payroll. And they don't see it as being an advantage beyond that. So it's a necessary evil, which if you think about it, that's a mindset. That's why they kind of go, well, it's whoever does it the cheapest. Yeah, I want to pay the minimum amount of tax, but actually, and even then they think they're being clever by, they might pay a bit more money to an accountant because they're a bit cleverer about further lowering their tax bill. But I feel like they're missing 80% plus of the value. Parlaying that onto your analogy of the car, the historic accounts is the rearview mirror, right? So what is the forward-facing stuff.
Yeah, so forward-facing stuff, it still does require that little glance into the background. So we do need to look. The best data we've got to help predict the future is the stuff that's happened in that immediate past. So we still need to be looking at, you know, in terms of incomes and expenses, we can look at profit, and we can also look at cash flow. But what we need to start doing then is start setting budgets. So we can start planning out for the future and then start recording some key sort of performance indicators, so we can actually monitor some of that, see how things are performing against the budget. So we've got more and more data that we can build upon. We can start building cash flow forecasts. So again, we can start to predict what's cash going to look like in the future. Can we foresee any problems with that? And if you can, if we can see it ahead of time, then actually you can go ahead, you can get financing if it's appropriate, but you can also make better informed decisions, maybe get better rates because you're doing it in advance, not actually I need finance because I've run out of money and I need it like now. So you can plan that into that. You can look at, we try and make sure business owners are making sure that they're focusing on what's the end goal, what are you trying to achieve? Because actually we spend a lot of our time doing activities and things that are outside of what we're trying to actually achieve, and they're just wasted time. So a great thing, and I've been there, I've done it myself. And one of the things that I do actually is going, if I'm doing a task, if I look at it and go, if I go home at the end of the day and I speak to my wife and I go, what I've been doing was X, Y, and Z, is she going to go, oh, that's great, because that moves us to what we're trying to achieve personally in our personal lives? Or is she going to let go of me, why have you wasted all day? And that's one of the things that we can also do with helping planning things out and looking at where things are trying to go. You're making sure that you're keeping on track of that bigger picture. So I think the big difference between the business owners who are viewing accountants as more valuable than just filing tax returns is because they've got a view of where they're trying to get to and the success that they're trying to achieve in the future, not just I want to pay less tax. And that's the main focus, I think, if that negative mindset towards accountants is about trying to save tax, whereas actually it's a bigger picture. It shouldn't be the case that maybe accountants are saving tax. Actually, in some respects, they should be helping you pay more tax because they're helping the business be more successful, and tax is almost a byproduct of that success.
In recessionary times, the middle gets squeezed. What does that mean? So in recessionary times, generally, there's less money available, albeit right now it seems to be the most liquid recession in living memory. And when people are uncertain, so actually let's not talk about access to capital, when people are uncertain about the future, they're less likely to spend. But when they need to make a transaction, okay, sometimes people go, money's tight, I want the cheapest. So they negotiate harder, they cut out costs. So margins are squeezed. Customers may flood to the low-cost providers, right? That makes sense. However, it's the middle that gets squeezed because actually, when people are unsure, they need to feel a greater certainty of success. So recession growth strategy number one was super niching. Recession growth strategy number two is strategic alliances. Recession growth strategy number three is bolt-on acquisitions. What does this mean, and then why is it important? So a bolt-on acquisition is buying another company and putting it together with what you've already got. Now, it can take a variety of different forms, which is beyond the capacity of what we're going to do in this brief summary. But effectively, the reason why it's important is in recessionary times, the sum is greater than its parts. So the concept behind mergers and acquisitions in general is, if you take two businesses and put them together, their revenues typically are higher than the combination because of cross-sell opportunities, and their expenses often go down because there's synergies and save costs. They don't need two accountants. They don't need two office spaces. They can combine to one, right? So therefore, revenue goes up, cost goes down. Therefore, the profit is much greater and the company is larger and typically more stable. So the multiple goes up, okay? So that's the concept of mergers and acquisitions. Now, normally, there is a lot, Paul, of risk that can go with the transaction, okay? There can be a lot of risk, which you have to figure out how to handle. Now, the reason why this is a recession growth strategy especially is, when everybody's hurting, typically asset prices go down. Typically. And the reason why I say typically is because it's such a weird recession with so much liquidity being pumped into the markets. That may not be the case this time, albeit I would strongly suspect it is. And it already shows up in certain industries before others. But we've got asset prices go down. So I think it was in April, the number of cars sold, it was either April or May. The number of cars, new cars that were registered in either April or May this year, was the lowest number of cars that had been registered in an April or May since 1945. Talk about that. You know, a few masterminds ago, I gave you all a lecture about buying cars. It's fucking crazy and don't do it. But the point being, can you get a very, very, very good deal in a car if you want to? The answer is yes, because they're desperate for the sales because supply and demand dictate price. Okay. So if a company is weakened, its price goes down. The price of businesses for sale goes down significantly. And if those assets in your hands are more valuable, there can be tremendous leverage. Now, that could take the form of distressed acquisition, i.e. a business is literally going to fail. It's going to go under. It's insolvent. Okay, and don't worry about the different terminology, but you know, whether it's administration or whether it's going through a liquidation, but you can buy those assets for pennies in the pound. So Jim Radcliffe, 2 years ago, was the richest man in the UK. I don't remember what his net worth was, but in his book, The Alchemist, he documents how he did it. And basically, it was buying unwanted or unloved assets for about 30p in the pound. So he's got the largest privately held company. I forget what the revenues are. I want to say it's 60 billion a year. I could be off on that, but that's the number. Either way, it's quite a lot of money, right? And fundamentally, all he did is all petrochemicals. So he's got massive production facilities. He buys them off people like BP and big oil companies when they don't want certain refineries. It's no longer part of their strategic plan. They sell it off cheap to get it off and get rid of the cost of running those plants. And he figures out how to make them work more efficiently, gives them a lowball offer. Metaphorically, it's like he finds somebody that's desperate to sell their house and he offers them 30% of the house's value. And the company goes, yeah, we want to sell this house because it's costing us so much money every month and we're going to go broke if we don't. So bolt-on acquisitions is saying right now, I'm telling you, hands down, I just want to reinforce how damn well this room is doing. Exceptionally well compared to the small business market out there. And there are competitors of yours that are desperately hurting, and you can figure out a way to merge the companies together or buy bits of their companies or do a whole host of different ways that it could be done where you can bolt on their revenue into your business and you get the profit and it's cheap and it'll give you much more rapid scalability than virtually anything else if it's done the right way. I mean, the ideal business would actually, well, you can buy businesses that are distressed and you can follow insolvency law to buy the good bits of the assets and leave behind the debt and things like that. It's quite technical. We've got a skill day coming up on this topic, but it's not just about distressed acquisition. It's about mergers and acquisitions in general. If you could choose, you'd choose to buy a good business, but the owner's distressed, so they need to sell, right? Because if the business is distressed, it's got problems, it's got debt, you need to cut off costs, you need to cut off product lines, you need to close a site, you need to make some people redundant in order for it to work. Well, you can do all that if you have the skills that the current owner doesn't have. Okay, great. But actually, if the business is just printing money, it's good, it's solid, it's stable, it's got a high BPM score, metaphorically, going back to this housing metaphor, it's like somebody's got a house, but they need to move abroad for work, so they need to sell it now. So they're willing to take a discount on the price because they need to get out of the country. Okay, great. But the house is in perfect condition. That's probably an easier transaction than one where it's a great house, but it needs all the electrics rewiring. It needs, because unless you know how the electrics work and the likely costs, there's risk that you could buy just a custom S. Anyway, Onassis? He said the secret, I'm paraphrasing slightly, I think, the secret to success is knowing something the competition doesn't know. It feels like a grown-up concept, but it only feels like a grown-up thing and a complex thing because it is complex if you don't know how to do it. Give a round of applause for Mr. Neil Maxwell Keys. Tell everybody about your business.
Okay, I run an online training company. We've got four major niches. We've got a photography training brand, a writing brand, and brand in the football market, and one in a random obscure niche called urban sketching. And within each one of those online platforms, we've got a series of online courses. So photography, we've got a general photography course, a portrait photography course, landscape, and so on. And then within that, we also have like a subscription service as well for people who want ongoing support and information. So I'll start, long story. My original kind of niche that I was in was the cruise ship industry, because I used to work on cruise ships about 20 years ago. So it started out as a downloadable ebook, giving people information to get into the industry. Then that became a membership site which I sold in about 2008, something like that. Then I started an online course in the cruise line industry, same kind of thing, health and safety on board and all that kind of stuff. When kind of online courses weren't around, there was no off-the-shelf platforms and things, I had to kind of learn how to develop the whole thing myself. And then I realized it was a very small kind of niche. You know, there's only so many people that want to work in the cruise industry. And one of the clients that we were working with said, you know, we're not really making a lot off this. Can you develop us a photography course? This was back in 2012. I know absolutely nothing about photography. I still don't, to be honest. And I said, yeah, sure. Yeah, we'll get one of them together. I know loads of photographers, didn't know any. And it took us about 2 or 3 weeks. We put this course together. And that's really when the business took off, because we were suddenly in a bigger market with people that actually had money to spend, as opposed to job seekers in the kind of early 20s with no money in terms of the cruise industry stuff. So, yeah, and from there, I bought the rights to various kind of courses. So the first course was a children's writing course, and it was a children's author who'd written this wonderful course but didn't know how to kind of sell it and get it online. Well, he wrote it. In fact, it was written in the early 2000s, and it was so out of date, actually, that he still had references to Jimmy Savile in a children's writing course. And I didn't realise as well. I published it online, and someone said, why are you talking about Jimmy Savile in a children's writing course? And I went, shit! There was a section about biographies on well-known people and, you know, respected people. So I've been through all kinds of... had all kinds of hiccups along the way. And then that made me realise that there was a bit of a market there. Then I kind of acquired other courses from authors. So fiction writing course, romance writing course, built out the writing kind of niche, if you like. And then more recently, the urban sketching. But anyway, to answer your question, the business grew quite significantly between 2012 to 2015. We went from, you know, me in the back bedroom, just about kind of making ends meet, which was about 60K a year in total revenue, to that was probably 2011, 2015, not far off 2.5 million in revenue. And we won fastest growth. Our office was where I live in Chester, which is just the side of the border from Wales. Well, our office was actually classes in Wales, and we won fastest growing international business in Wales, fastest growing educational provider. But the problem was that was all off the back of one client. So we had literally 95% plus of our revenue was coming from a single partner. So Dan mentioned before about, you know, you can change your life overnight with a joint venture. That is true. And it literally changed our lives overnight. Again, you know, from a personal point of view, I went from, you know, struggling to pay the mortgage to paying my mortgage off within about 3 months. And then, but, you know, as you know, when you're relying on the number one, you're setting yourself up for fall, and that kind of dropped off quite rapidly.
Let me just pause, you know, because there's so much good stuff in here. So let me rewind a bit. There's a few points that I was marking out. First of all, it was said a few minutes ago. I just want to emphasize it for everybody in here. There's the distinction about the avatar, right? As in, he said the business significantly changed early in its process when he went from broke 20-year-old somethings that were wanting to work on cruise ships to the photography, right? So there's a distinction there about, okay, which market are we serving? There's also a distinction about, in some respects, I'm going to say Neil's business was more scalable, not just because it was product-based, but because he was on the business side, i.e. he figured out the business side. I don't know photography, but it's an in-demand niche. Okay, great. I'll find somebody that can give us the content to create the course. I'm now going to be the architect of bringing together the systems and the process so it works. Also within photography, not just a larger market, but there were subsets of different types of photography which would not have existed, I can't imagine, within the cruise industry niche. Okay, there are 3 points. And then, on the partnership, obviously it might be because he's on tape, might be a reason why he doesn't want to mention, but a well-known provider in that space platform that sells stuff was a partner that allowed Neil's business to scale radically, which went from struggling to pay mortgage to paying mortgage off. Phenomenal leverage. But simultaneously, the flip side of that coin is if they change their mind, all of a sudden you're in a world of hurt.
I hope you enjoyed that episode.
three things you need to do now. Number one, make sure you subscribe to this podcast so you do not miss an episode. Also, get on over to Amazon to get a copy of my latest book, Turnover is Vanity, Profit is Sanity, 9.5 Steps to Improving Your Profits and Cash Flow. Also, join our Facebook group, the Turnover is Vanity, Profit is Sanity community, to connect with other business owners.